Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're rocking and rolling already today. And we're really going to start rocking when Joan joins us, which is right now. Joan Pride is senior editor with a couple of new editors, and boy, howdy, I just don't know what we'd do without her. Joan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jim. Thanks very much.
It's good to have you back.
I just don't know
what we'd do without you, Joan.
I know. I wonder that myself.
Who would insult me?
Right.
Who would I have to put me in my place if it weren't for you?
Exactly.
You know, and you know, there are other people who do that. You know, for some reason, they're all women.
Hmm. I wonder why.
I don't know. What does that say? Does that say something about me, or does that say something about women? I don't know.
Well, now you're getting way too philosophical.
There you go. And the audience is saying, we don't care.
You're right.
Did you know that on this day in 1789, the first U.S. Congress began their first regular session? Did you hear me say that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, and do you know where that first session was?
Let me guess. Was it Philadelphia?
No.
Or New York?
It was in New York.
Okay.
How about that?
Yeah.
It still amazes me, though, that they started out in Philadelphia, or maybe they started in New York and then went to Philadelphia. I forgot where they went. Well, the Continental Congress was in Philadelphia.
Right.
And then they moved the Congress to New York.
Well, the capital of the country was New York for a while.
Exactly.
Until they built Washington.
But that's what amazes me. It still amazes me that they carved out, that they decided that, and I know there were discussion between the Virginians and all that about the representatives from Virginia and all that, but it still amazes me that they picked the place that they picked in what is now Washington, D.C. Doesn't it amaze you? Because it's a swamp.
Oh, yeah. Whoever had that vision was pretty amazing, I think.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you would have thought that they would have said, you know what, New York's good enough.
Right.
I frankly am glad that it didn't turn out to be New York.
Well, I think that was a geographical consideration. I think Washington wanted it a little bit more in what he thought of as the middle of the country.
Right. No, I think you're right. No, I agree with you. I don't disagree. And I've forgotten which family. Didn't some family donate that land? Wasn't his family, but...
I don't think so.
But anyway, it still amazes me that they picked that place. Maybe they said, you know what? This isn't good for anything else. Let's give it to the government. We can't grow anything here, and you know, nobody wants to go there. Too many mosquitoes and snakes, so let's just put the government in there.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah. Hey, Joan, by the way, how are the cherry trees, cherry blossoms?
Well, I think they're just about losing their blossoms at the moment. They're, you know, we've had a good week or so with them, but we've had some severe wind, and we're going to get some rain. So I think they're just about at the end, and we're just about at the end of the Cherry Blossom Festival, so this year worked out.
Is this the week of the Cherry Blossom Festival?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so this actually got the timing was good this year?
Which never happens, I know.
How long has that been in your lifetime?
Boy, very, very rare.
Because we've complained about that year after year. Now we didn't have anything to complain about this year.
I know,
and
the only
good news for me is I didn't get to Washington for the Cherry Blossoms, although I'll be there next week. They'll be gone. But I am in Baltimore, and guess what? They have cherry blossoms.
Oh, I'll bet they're beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, they are. So I got to see that, so I'm excited about that. Joan, let's move over and talk about some of the worker shortage issues that you guys report on this week. There are, you know, the employment rate, the unemployment rate, I should say, is now just dipping below 5%.
Yes.
Which is really good, And the reason why it's so good, Joan, is because we had this kind of this low in unemployment 7 or so years ago. But you and I both know that was an artificial issue. We actually had people working in jobs that really shouldn't have been working because those companies shouldn't have even been in existence. I'm talking about the dot-coms that most of which went under, many of which went under.
Yes.
But now we don't have any of that. Popular delusions and madness of crowds. We've got a serious economy that's hitting on at least 7.5 of its cylinders. And the employment that we see, the high employment we see, the new jobs that are happening, these are solid jobs, and yet you guys are still reporting that we're going to have a worker shortage.
Right, and not just any workers, but we're saying mainly jobs for skilled workers, but also jobs that we just can't fill with people in this country, mm-hmm. which are also lesser skilled jobs.
Right. And which brings us back around to the immigration issue, which I don't want to necessarily wander off into
right
now, but that's exactly right. And Joan, you know, everywhere I go, when I speak, when I attend events on small businesses, I was in Joplin, Missouri this week, and I gave 3 speeches, and a guy came up to me, and he said, "What can you do to help me find good people?"
Wow.
And that happens to me everywhere I go.
No
either
kidding.
Somebody asks me about that, or when there's a panel, I do a lot of panel moderating, and people have an opportunity to ask questions. And when they do that, invariably, and I mean invariably, someone says, at least one person stands up and says, "My biggest problem is I can't get qualified people."
Have you noticed it's been happening more lately?
It's been growing. It's been a problem, really, in my opinion, it's been a problem for 4 or 5 years at least.
Okay.
But I do think it is, and let me put it this way. For a long time, health care was the number one issue, followed by finding good workers.
Yes.
I actually think anecdotal thinking about this, I think that those have reversed. I think if you ask the average person
out
there, and here's why, is, you know, if they don't have the kind of health care that they need, or they can't provide health care, they
right
can still operate their business.
Sure.
And hope to grow into being able to offer health care for their employees.
Yes.
But if they don't have good workers, they can't operate successfully.
No question, right.
So this is a big deal, and so consequently the unemployment rate's down. We're creating, what, 200,000 jobs a year now?
Yes.
I mean a month, a couple hundred thousand a month?
Right.
And what is, and we all know, Joan, you guys report on this week, that's going to put upward pressure on wages, isn't it?
Well, it kind of has to. If you're working as hard as you can to attract and keep good employees, pay is going to be a part of that equation. So, and we're saying things aren't going to get any better because of population trends.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, that as the population ages, baby boomers move into retirement, you're going to have fewer people in work ages.
The immediate generation replacing the baby boomers is a lot smaller than the baby.
Right.
It's the generational wave issue, which we're going to pick up on when we come back right after these messages. That's great music, ladies and gentlemen. Jefferson Airplane. Classic. Just like me, right, Joan?
Oh, no question, sure. Whatever you say.
No, relic, I think, is the word you use, not classic. When you.
Oh, I would never say that.
No, you never would you? Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And thanks for staying with us. Joan, we were talking about the generational wave. This is, to me, one of the most interesting phenomena about the marketplace and about human beings is what the demographers call generational waves. And as you know, and we've had several demographers on the show before, and they remind us that there were about 20 million or so GI generation, my parents, your parents' generation.
Right.
Then there was the silent generation, some people call the Korean War generation, that was about 10 million. The GI generation are mostly very late 70s and beyond. The silent generation is typically late 60s and 70s. And now we're getting into the baby boomers are just about to turn 60. And there are 80 million of them, 76 to 80 million, depending on who you talk to. The generation behind us, Joan, the Gen Xers, is about 30 million. It's my understanding.
Wow.
And they're the ones.
That's a big difference.
Well, and see, they're the people who are coming of age into their 30s to take some of these, you know, positions of influence, positions of management.
Right.
And they're not as many to replace the baby boomers.
Oh, yeah.
And the Gen Ys, which is the generation behind them, typically teenagers, that kind of thing, they're just too young.
Right. That's right.
So therein lies, it's not that we don't have people in America. We got about the same number of people. They're just not diffused across the economy in a
right.
way that helps us when we need to hire qualified people.
Exactly. Oh, gee.
And so we need some of these immigrants, don't we? Some of these people who can come in and take them in.
Yeah. I don't know how we get along without them.
Well, that's true. And of course, we're not talking about the immigrants that's the big controversy right now, the illegal immigrants. That's not who we're
right.
talking about. Although, as you know, Joan, what are your thoughts on you know, how we should, you've got any thoughts on the immigration issue as far as, you know, we've got all these people here and they're all working, basically.
Right.
But they're
well, I mean, that's a whole other discussion we could have if you'd like to have it. But, I mean, I can give you both sides of the argument if you want.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want to give us a quick tour, I mean, the thing is the 12,000 illegal immigrants are not, they're doing important work, but they're not doing the work that you guys are reporting on today, the people, the high-paying, high-qualified jobs that...
Well, that's some of them, but we also say that jobs need to be filled that Americans don't want, roofers, busboys, janitors, and landscapers.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the illegals...
In many cases, jobs. Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's another thing, Joan, on this immigrant thing. My friend Dan Heenan, not Dan Heenan, what's his first name? I'm trying to think. Last name is Heenan. He wrote a book called Flight Capital. He says that a lot of these highly skilled immigrants that used to flock to the United States are not coming here, or if they come here for education, they're not staying here, they're going home.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. A lot of the ones that come here for education finally end up going back, and that's a real
right.
brain drain for us, I think.
We've relied. I think Americans don't realize how much we've relied on that brain power.
Right.
Over the years, right.
Yeah, I think we have.
Now, so Joan, and if we've got this shortage of workers, highly qualified workers, and we do, I believe that we do, those who are available can demand more. It's a seller's market, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. And that's where you get wages driven up, and then you have to think about inflation.
Yeah. That was one of the big concerns that the Fed had back in the late 90s, wasn't it?
That's right.
When they raised rates, because remember when they didn't believe that the lower unemployment, they felt that that was going to be highly inflationary because they didn't believe the productivity numbers, did they?
Right.
And so now the question is going to be to me, has the Fed learned their lesson?
Well, that's something we'll find out, certainly.
Right, and so to move over to pull something over from page two over into this discussion, which I think is important or appropriate, you say that the Fed's going to raise rates one more time this year.
Yep, another quarter point, and that'll be in May.
5.5% on the Fed funds rate, which will
right.
make prime 8.
8.
And we'll make
wow.
small business owners borrow money at higher than that because we
that
live in the
prime
world.
Plus.
Prime plus, right?
That's right.
And so, but Joan... What I think, the reason I wanted to stick this in there is because I think we'll see later in the year, because this employment thing is not going to change anyway soon. This dearth of qualified employees
right.
is not going to change anyway soon. If the Fed raises rates, in my opinion, any more after this next time, I think that'll be an indication of what they do, I should say, will be an indication of whether they believe that low unemployment is inflationary. And harmful to the economy,
right?
Or if they believe that we've just become more productive, and the output is enough, but it's not an unfortunate issue. That's not the right word to say. It's a very tough issue, and I'm not sure, Joan, that there's a solution for it. Do you?
That's a good point.
I don't think we have one. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Sarbanes-Oxley and the impact that legislation has on small businesses who want to become public and public small companies that may want to go private.
Yep, he's done it again, folks.
Oh, no, not again. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Named to Talkers Magazine's Heavy 100 for the third year in a row.
It's not the first time. It won't be the last.
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thanks very much for hanging around with us. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. Joan Pride is with us. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger editor. And Joan, on page 2, you guys have a great report here on what you call the unintended results of Sarbanes-Oxley. And I think this is a very important. You know, I heard an attorney yesterday in a conference. I heard an attorney talk about the virtues of Sarbanes-Oxley.
Hmm.
And I said, you know, only an attorney or a CPA would say that. Because it's become a legal and accounting retirement plan, Sarbanes-Oxley. And folks, in case if you don't know what that is, right after the Enron meltdown, the WorldCom meltdown, the Adelphia meltdown, et cetera, when all that was heating up so much, well, actually, Adelphia was later, I guess. Senator Sarbanes and Senator Oxley, Democrat and Republican, respectively, came up with a bill that put all kinds of new requirements on publicly traded companies. And it was a reaction to all this corporate malfeasance. And, Joan, you know that there was already laws on the books against what those people did.
Right. Well, I mean, the intention was good because there was a lot of fallout from the disasters, the corporate disasters such as Enron and WorldCom, but the bill was kind of done in haste, and a lot of businesses afterwards said that they put too many restrictions on companies, and the real problem was the reporting requirements, all the new reporting that had to be done to the SEC, and what we're saying in the Kiplinger letter of this week is that it's caused private companies who may want to go public to maybe pause and take a second look at that plan.
Well, no, Joan, you won't be surprised to know that I did a little research back when Sarbanes-Oxley was being considered, and it actually, I don't remember 60 or 90 days, but somewhere between 60 or 90 days is how long it took that bill to go through Congress. And the research that I found that it seemed that there was only one other example in the history of the U.S. Congress when something went through Congress that fast.
I'll bet that was prohibition.
It probably was. And, I mean, I don't remember what the issue was, and I apologize for that. I actually knew it one time. I just don't remember. But what the news was to me was that they rushed this through.
Yeah.
The point that I wrote at the time was anything the government does that fast is good. You know, and so usually we're ticked off because they're not moving fast enough. This was a case where they moved too fast.
Too fast.
And I don't think they really understood the issues. And basically, anytime the government is moving that fast to tell the marketplace how they must behave when the government can't even make its own self behave very well, that's a dangerous thing. And so now we're left with Sarbanes-Oxley, what we have. And,
right.
And I really want to thank you guys for Kiplinger, Joan, for pointing this out. This is a real problem it's a big problem for big companies, but they got lots of help. They got plenty of money. The smaller companies, when I say smaller, I mean the small private companies, the ones who barely justify going private, and the companies that are growing who want to go private. Sarbanes-Oxley has, as you guys point out, has added all this new corporate requirements, all these new accounting requirements, all the new oversight requirements, and it's gotten to the point where it's too expensive.
Right, for a lot of companies. And that's why some of them are just deciding, you know, we're going to stay public. And you've got private equity funds
Private.
Pardon me?
You meant stay private, didn't you?
I'm sorry. Yes, yeah, stay private. And you've got private equity funds out there that are ready and willing to give them money so that there are sources of capital for them without going into the public markets if they don't want to.
Right. Well, as I think you know, we've interviewed a bank and a small furniture company that both went public. And after Sarbanes-Oxley, they both went private after that. Yeah. They both went public in the 90s, and now they've gone private. And I've had the chairman and the founder of a company on this show, a $1 billion a year sales company that went public in 95, and he told me if I had to go public today, I wouldn't. I probably couldn't. He'd have to rethink that. And now this is a company that's created a lot of wealth for a lot of people, investors and employees and everything, because
right.
he was able to go public, because he
wow.
was able to get access to capital. So my point is, there's one of the downsides. We will never know how much opportunity has been lost because of Sarbanes-Oxley.
Right.
Because a few bad apples poisoned the barrel. And that's the reason why I think the government overreacted with Sarbanes-Oxley. 22, I'm Jim Blasingame. We'll be right back with Joan Pryde. Stay with us. Advocate broadcasting live from Baltimore, Maryland, but tomorrow I'll be back to regular. Back to my regular environs. Notice I didn't use the word normal. Joan Pryde is with us. And Joan, you know we never use that word normal around here. There's nothing normal about what we do.
You knew I would have jumped right on that if you had said normal.
That's exactly. I'm not going to serve them up for you there, Joan. You get your own all by yourself.
Yep.
Let's talk about, folks, I want to remind you about Kiplinger's website. I always like telling people about Kiplinger because they do good work, they do good things, and they don't pay me a nickel to say this, and because I really have admired the work that they do. It's a family-owned business, it's a small business. Even though they're not tiny, they are a small family-owned business, and they do some great work. They've got a website that I encourage you to check out, kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R, and they've got publications that are world-class. Nobody else does anything like they do. Their flagship is the Kiplinger Letter. And now in its 84th year, I think it is, and comes every week by email or by print form. And then there's three biweekly letters, right, Joan? The agriculture
right.
tax letter, and the California letter, and the did I say that twice? The tax letter, the agriculture letter, and the California letter.
You got them all. Yes.
Then there's the magazine, Joan.
That's right, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine,
which many people know about, and you don't have to subscribe, but although I recommend you do. But you can also find it at newsstands. And
yeah.
don't forget to check out the website. And they still got that 30-day free trial I worked so hard on, Joan.
You bet.
So check that out, folks. Joan, let's move down and talk about car dealers. You know, Ford and GM are having a tough time. GM's more in the news these days because their problems seem to be multiplying. We won't go into all those reasons, but they've got lots and lots of challenges. And as you know, Joan, I predicted at least one U.S. car company would go bankrupt this year, and I said it would probably be GM. And
yes.
And the truth is all the really bad news hadn't even happened when I said that back in December. I just had a feeling about it. But let's talk about what Kiplinger has to say about car dealers. You say that many of them are going to close up.
That's right, which is rather disturbing, but it kind of figures given that you know these auto giants are in trouble and they're kind of forcing out marginal sellers if they don't have good service or they have high inventories.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to strengthen the brand name, and they figure that's how they can do it.
Well, see, this is the problem. Blaming
killing the messenger, kind of?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Well, no, I know some dealers. And, the problem is not the dealer. The problem is the manufacturer. And the dealers that I know have continued over the years to get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and so that it's harder and harder for them to make a good living, to make a profit,
yeah.
and to be successful in the car dealership because of the challenges that their brand has been forcing downstream to them.
That's right.
They've been trying to get them to help them with their problems, and so I don't blame the dealers. But Joan, one of the things that I think is going to happen with car dealers is something that's happened with almost every industry, and that's the internet. You know, an automobile is more.
Oh yeah.
It's more of a commodity than ever before.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to happen soon. But I think before long you'll be able to go online, order your car, and just go pick it up at a basically at a delivery point. Not necessarily.
Well,
not go kicking around, kicking tires on a car lot. Oh, I think I'll take the blue one. You'll already know you want the blue one. You pick it out online, and you'll buy it, and they'll finance it for you, and you'll pay for it through PayPal or whatever. And I think that's the future of the car business.
Right, and some of them are not doing that now, but you can at least go online to see what's in stock and know where you want to go. Know that, okay, that silver Buick is going to be at that dealership today if I get there soon enough.
Well, and not only that, I think some websites actually have the ability for you to pick out your car and say, please tell this dealer, which they help you find, that this is the car you want, and it'll be there in 3 days or whatever. I think.
Oh, yeah.
But you still got to go to a dealership, a full service, 250 cars on the lot dealership.
Right.
And I think, Joan, you and I've talked about this just-in-time inventory thing that's really helped the economy over the years. Car manufacturers are going to have to do that too.
Right. I mean, as you say, the internet has wrung efficiencies out of so many different lines of work, and this may be the next one.
Right. But one thing's about it, it will change the way that'll be an interesting, or maybe some people think an unfortunate direction for Americana to go in, where we have no car dealers I don't think we'll have no car dealers. I just think they'll look different over the years.
Yeah.
Coming down the pike. Joan, let's move over quickly and talk about Mr. Bush's defense issues. You guys point out this week that the Bush Doctrine, a preemptive military action, is secure. Now, what about that?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a nuance here. We're saying it's not going to go away, that the administration will continue to believe in preemptive military action, but we're also saying that Congress will raise the bar for a preemptive strike, require, I guess, more documentation and international support before you could go ahead with something like that in the future.
Yeah, Iraq has given rise to that for sure, no question
right.
about it. But I do think that we can't be naive, and we've got to realize that there are people, there are evil people out there who mean some of us harm.
Right.
And if we wait, I don't think we can wait for those. I think we need to presume those people are going to strike us. And we can't, in my opinion, we can't wait for them to do that. I think
preemption
is an important part of our strategy that's got to be maintained. Stand by, Joan. Quick break. Right back after these messages. I'm Jim Blasingame. Stay with me. Welcome back. It's 7 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, I'm coming to see you next week.
Wow.
You're pretty excited about that, too, aren't you?
I can't stand it,
You're on Twitter, aren't you?
Twitter, that's the word.
I'm going to be coming to Washington, D.C. to help the SBA celebrate Small Business Week again.
Great. Well, that's going to be huge.
Our ninth year in a row.
Wow.
So we've already alerted the authorities, and I've got a permit to assemble up there. So everything's going to be legal. You'll be glad to know about that.
Very good.
But I'm going to try to drop by and say hi to you guys, because your office. I'm actually going to be in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building.
Ooh, well,
which,
but you're just
near you.
Down the road.
Yeah, just down the street there. And
that's right.
And so I'll be dropping by, and so you can prepare yourself for that. Joan, let's move down and talk about something that you reported on, which I've never heard you guys report on this. I think it's important, and it's the campaign issue, the campaign finance issue for independent judiciary judges who run for office, and the whole campaign financing of that. Now, why did you guys feel that you needed a report on that?
Well, I'm sure you've got some listeners saying, what are they talking about, judges raising money? They don't need to do that. Well, not all judges are appointed. The Supreme Court judges in 38 states are elected start with. So that's, and then you have to think of all the other judges at other levels that are elected. They're raising money.
That makes them politicians.
And they're behaving like politicians, exactly.
That's exactly right. But it's not just Supreme Courts. District judges.
That's right.
Of course, probate judges are elected, I guess, maybe in all states. But district judges, circuit judges, the whole level of judges. In fact, in many states, there's not a single judge that's appointed unless they're just appointed to fill a slot where someone died or resigned or something.
But think about how that kind of money could influence a judge's decision in a civil case, say.
Right. Now, I will say, Joan, that I know many judges who are elected.
Yes.
And I have to say that I'm really proud of the way they behave. And I think this goes back to the corporate malfeasance thing, Joan. You know, there were you and I could name maybe 10 or 15 companies that really were the offenders. But there are 15,000 publicly traded companies. So 99.whatever% of corporate executives are honest brokers, honest people.
Yeah.
And I think we can say the same thing probably about the judiciary. But it does create some potential conflict, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
And so what did Kiplinger determine about all that?
Well, that's what's kind of scary is we didn't determine. I mean, what we determined was that this raises questions about undue influence, but we don't really have anything in here saying, you know, how you fix this. I'm not sure how you do fix it.
So Kiplinger basically identified a problem, but they didn't identify a solution, Joan.
Right, because I'm not sure what the solution would be.
That's not like you guys.
No.
You always
this
have
is
an
a
opinion.
Tough nut.
You always have an opinion about how things should be.
That's true. That's true.
Joan, let's move over quickly and talk about, at the bottom of page 3, the U.S. crackdown on overseas-based Internet scams. Now, what do you know about this?
Well, this is good because the Federal Trade Commission is getting broader power to work with foreign governments to stop our favorites, spam and spyware, and to try to cut down on identity theft, which is, as you know, incredibly important.
It is a big one. Folks, Joan, as you know, I've been working with IBM on some security conferences, and I have learned so much in hearing these experts speak. I've been emceeing the conferences and moderating the panels, and I've heard these world-class experts speak, and it'll scare the bejeebers out of you when you hear some of the things that's going on. Folks, I don't care if you're Aunt Minnie and all you get are email of your grandkids, and that's all you do on your website, on your computer. If you're connected to the Internet in any way, especially with broadband connectivity, you must buy security systems, security software, and you must keep it updated.
Absolutely.
We don't have time to go into all the reasons. Just trust me on that. We'll talk about that some more. But I'm glad to see the government focusing on it, Joan. But I'll tell you what, these people are pretty determined, these people who want to assault our computers.
Yeah, you kind of have to be ever vigilant.
And, Joan, it used to be all these hackers and all that. It used to be just kind of, you know, pranksters. Now
yeah.
It's a huge international industry.
Oh, very professional.
Billions
That's right.
of dollars. Billions
That's right.
of dollars involved. Hey, Joan, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
Good job today, as always, and we'll see you next week.
Enjoy Baltimore, Charm City.
Thank you, and I will see you next week.
Very good.
Thanks. Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen, she'll be back. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program, as you know, is for you. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.